This is Surviving the Music Industry.
That sounds sick.
I didn't think about how that sounded.
Hey, thanks. This is the thing. This is what you walk into. It's a little awkward. We don't know what to do with our hands. Do we hold our hands? Do we fold them? What do you do on the struggle bus? I don't know. Either way, I'm here with you. You're listening to SMI, Surviving the Music Industry with Brandon Harrington. It is I. It's where it's a little bit self-loathing. There's some degradation of the soul that usually happens, and it comes from my end, usually in this section, in this part. And then we get to have pretty rad conversation with people along the way, my journey of surviving the music industry. Woo! Things aren't well. They're okay. I'm sure they're okay for a lot of people. I like to check in first. I always like to know how you folks are doing before I just go on a rant. So, first of all, how you guys doing? Everybody doing okay? You're feeling well? Is everybody's Dogecoin doing okay? At the stocks, what about the stock market? Are you somewhere of like between success and cashing in and then paying those taxes, or you just kind of what am I doing here? Are you just regretting your life in this current situation? Becky, I put our life savings in the Doge. What did I do? Well, it was going to be a good buy. No, it wasn't a good buy. Elon Musk controls the market. One tweet and he blows up. Well, I mean, he is a little awkward. But Becky, he smokes the pot. He smokes the pot. Why did we listen to him? Why? I don't know where that was going. But you're along for the ride either way. Again, you're on the struggle bus and I'm holding your hand. Again, just keep in touch with everybody and everything that's kind of going on in your headspace. You never know where people are at. You never know what people are going through. Just keep in touch. Add us to my podcast or at Unofficial Brandon on the grams and the talks. It's where I get to showcase a little bit of my personality. I usually stay a little bit more active on the grams because the people of Facebook, I mean, there's normies out there. There's normal people. And within the normal people, there are some weird ones. I'm a weird normal person. Okay, I would never write an angry letter just because somebody upset me or troll somebody just for the fun of it. Like, but I like nerdy stuff and I'm just a weird dude, obviously, if you follow my social stuff. But at the same time, it's just to make you laugh, to make you feel something, calm down. But the thing about it is like Facebook, what is this? What is this land of desolation of just weird ass people that you wouldn't even be friends with them in real life? And we all know who I'm talking about. We all know that person. We all know this group of people that we're seeing on your Facebook page. Like, who is this person? I said hi, maybe randomly at some random party. Hey, how you doing? Oh, Facebook friends, boom. And then it turns out, I don't know, that, I don't know. They like to juggle cats and chainsaws at the same time. So, I don't know. I stay active on the grams. You guys are tuning in because of this conversation with the Gym Beavers. I'm a huge fan. I had man crush him. I only had an hour with the dude, and we got to know him, got to do the whole thing. And it was so much fun. It was such an honor, such a legendary conversation, one of the top ones this year. Hope you guys know, like, we do episodes like every Tuesday, and we sprinkle some on Thursdays. I happen to be back from vacations, if you want to call it that. Arkansas is never a vacation. It's always just a lot of work. Go do this, go do that. You're helping like your in-laws and your family. You're doing the thing. It's never a vacation, but we're back. We're done. We're kind of like in getting back in normal society, or at least I am. The fam's kind of sticking around doing the thing. I'm back in the old Nash. Woo! Your boy is batching it up. What should I do? I don't know what to do with myself. Now I'm really contemplating this. Like, what do I do? What do single people do? I mean, I'm not single. I'm a bachelor. But it's like, whoa. I don't know what to do with my time. Just make more stupid videos? Maybe so. I don't know. Maybe go see a live show. What is this? Live music is back. And so maybe I should just pop in and go see a show. I haven't been to Whiskey Jam in years. I don't know. All those people, I don't know. I don't know what to do. You guys got any great ideas, just let me know. Well, I would say that my life is marginally okay. I had a good respite. Still the show, still kind of going on. American Songwriter Podcast Network is still a good family to be part of. I really got nothing to complain. And that's very rare for me. And sometimes I got to go through seasons of gratitude because I'll get under a depression blanket and I don't know what to do with myself. And so the more I start thinking about and contemplating, like, oh man, I got to do all these amazing things. I get to do this every day or whatever, instead of, you know, self-wallowing or self-pity myself into a depression blanket and just think, why am I not getting that, the thing that's the thing I currently don't have? It's so stupid. We do that. We do that all the time. When I was actively pursuing, you know, gigs, I lived in that depression house. It wasn't a blanket at that point, but it's just like, if I was just wanted to do that thing. Same with songwriting. I do that thing too. Like, if I just get a co-write, if I go to do that thing, now I kind of don't care. Like, what happens, happens. Is that the right place to be? I don't know. Seems to be a healthier headspace for me. I mean, you do you, right? So, whatever works for you, works for you. But all I got to say is just be grateful and live in gratitude. It's such a better place. But for Jim Beavers, I love this talk. I love it so much. So, Jim Beavers is an American songwriter from Nashville, but he's actually from Texas. So, we have that bond. We have that commonality. We hit it off really well. And cuts, and the cuts galore, especially with Dierks Bentley. He's got this great, unique relationship with Dierks Bentley. He has got this great story with one of his first cuts, How Am I Doing, Dierks Bentley's song. He signed off as Writer X because at the time he was a suit. He was doing the thing. He didn't want people to know that he wrote this song. So it's always fun. And just we went through his college years, his business mind, because he has an MBA, and I almost pursued the MBA, but like he wanted to shoot for the songwriting thing. So how did he do it? Where did he do it? How, like, what was the thing, like, especially for him? So we got to it. But some of the songs he wrote, Red Solo Cup, I'll lead off with that. He's not sick of it. So we talked about that one. I have officially talked to all the writers of Gary Allen's Watching Airplanes. I love that song so much. So from Singleton to Beavers now, got them both. Got them. And it was great to dig into that. Billy Currington cuts, some Josh Turner stuff, Tim McGraw, Drink a Beer, Luke Bryan. I'm not a huge Luke Bryan like fan, like music-wise, because I just don't think it's pointed toward me. But Drink a Beer is such a great song. Such a great song. Hootie and the Blowfish, Hold On. He is a funny dude. Jim Beavers is one of my favorite, funniest, low-key songwriters. And I tell him this. He doesn't understand what low-key means. It's fine. It, no biggie. But like, he'll hit you with something funny, you don't even know it. We talked about the relationship with his brother, the Beaver Brothers. They're a thing. He's a producer. And so we go through the whole gamut, everybody. We do the thing. And I got nothing to promote for the guy. He's just a great songwriter. You can't find him on the socials. He's probably got one, but he never uses it. You can't look up Jim Beaver. That's an actor. Don't click on the wrong thing, because we're talking to Jim Beavers, the songwriter, the cooler of the Jim Beaver. This is Jim Beavers. So, I don't know. I would say go listen to his music, all his cuts. I mean, you can Wikipedia, you can go visit us at smipodcast.com. We'll have links and stuff, some of the songs that he's written. Go check it out. But other than that, what do I need to set up here? I only had an hour with Jim, so we had to, like, fill it all in. And it was a lot of fun. Such a pleasure to know. So here's my conversation with the one and only Jim Beavers.
I'm at Big Yellow Dog right now, and then I don't know what your time constraints are. I only have an hour. I had an 11 o'clock thing. I don't know if that's enough time.
No, totally. That's perfect.
Okay, I was looking at some of your other ones, and they went longer, and I just wanted to let you know ahead of time that
some of that is me complaining.
I get that too. I mean, I'm good at that. I'm great at that.
Yeah, I don't know if you've ever done like another podcast or anything, so I don't know how this like floats in your world, but there's a lot of self-loathing on this side of the fence, self-deprecating, and a lot of jadedness.
The title of Surviving the Music Industry sets it up, you know, to where there's got to be a little bit of self-loathing and complaining going on. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing because, like, surviving the music industry is me, because I'm not, my life's a shit show. Like, I have no idea what's going on, and I get to talk to pretty rad people like yourself. And it's amazing how many people will take the title and just, like, unload.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if that's the focus, I mean, everybody's going to have some stories that would fit in with that narrative. Oh. It just depends on what you want to focus on, you know?
Oh, right, right. I mean, it's across the board. But, man, I am super stoked about this because I don't know who you are. Like, we've never met. We don't obviously go in the same circles because of popularity and wealth and gross income. But I think... But I'm super stoked about this because I'm a huge fan and I already know too much about you. I didn't have to do much work like with this whatsoever.
That weirds me out to think that anybody knows anything about me that I didn't tell them personally. I don't know if you're being gracious or you're being for real. I can't tell. I don't know.
I try to be as honest as possible. And okay. Yeah, that comes from a very sincere place, I really feel like, because you're Texas. I mean, we know one another. I mean, there's already that. We already know our own kind.
That's right. Where are you from specifically?
I'm from the Texarkana area.
Oh, nothing wrong with that. My wife grew up around Paris, you know.
Oh, yeah.
From Blossom, to be specific.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Northeast Texas has got their own thing going on for sure.
Right. And yep. And I kind of know this a little bit about you too, that Garland, is that right? That's coming to memory. It's Garland, Texas.
I was born in Midland, Texas, which is way west, as you know, and then lived in Garland for a while, then went to high school in Jacksonville, Texas, which is near Tyler. So more east. Yeah.
You saw pretty much the full state.
I did. I don't remember anything about Midland. I was too little, but I'm a big Texas guy. Texas history, Texana. I love it all. You know how we are. We're pretty obnoxious.
Yeah. There's the cool Texan. There's the Matthew McConaughey Texan. You know, all right, all right, all right. And then there's the other Texas, like the far extreme, which yeah, I don't know what that
is. I like Matthew McConaughey, man. When he was doing his book tour here recently, I listened to a couple of podcasts with him on it, and he's an interesting guy. He's from Longview, which is not far from where we're from. So I'm a fan of his for sure. My kids, I mean, this is not an original thing, but it's an absolutely ridiculous thing. You know, both my children were born here in Nashville, but they definitely had a box of Texas dirt under the delivery gurney.
You are 100% Texas. That explains it all.
The doctor saw the box and said, and he didn't, as a woman, actually, she didn't say anything. She just said, Texas. I said, yeah. And that was it.
That was it.
It's so obnoxious. And I tell them all the time, I said, you know, you're a Texan. They don't embrace it, but whatever. How long have you been out of Texarkana?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've been coming to Nashville since I was like 15, 16, like doing the thing, touring and stuff. And then, we've lived here. I always have to think about it. I think we're at 11 years living in Nashville.
Yeah.
Like having a bank and a credit card based in Nashville, like in a zip code. So yeah, it's about 11 years.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, man, you've seen most of the crazy boomy tons of Nashville there. Yeah.
Right. I mean, you're probably like me. I don't know when you moved into Nashville, but I remember, honestly, the only thing to do in Nashville, and I said, this is my usual joke, the only thing to do in Nashville was eat at Shoney's. Like, that's all you did.
Man, I don't even see any Shoney's anymore. I don't even, one of them closed down or something. I don't know.
Oh, well, see, now that's funny, because when I do mention that joke, the certain long in the tooth guys that have been around the block, they know exactly what Shoney's I'm talking about. And it's the one close to the stadium. Like, it's where...
Oh, yeah. It's gone. You know,
is it? It's finally gone?
I don't know. There used to be one right in Music Row. There was one down on, you know, Nolensville Road. There was one on White. You know where the it's funny you even bring it up, because my wife and I noticed that here in the last month or so. And I think buffets are out now. Obviously, COVID. Even pre-COVID, I felt like buffets were we're not cool anymore. So whatever.
Yeah, everybody thinks COVID came from a bat. It really came from an open buffet.
Specifically a Shoney's open buffet.
Oh, that's amazing. Okay, yeah, so, I mean, we have Texas blood. You're the annoying Texas. And here's something I feel like I can relate to you a little bit, because growing up in that area, I mean, you hear the names. You know the stars. Like, I mean, in my area, it was like Tracy Lawrence, and in my generation, too. It was Tracy Lawrence, Colin Ray, Leanne Womack, and I'm sure there's a few others in there. But along with that, I knew who the Beaver Brothers were, you know, because, like, these are the guys that they got out. Like, they're doing the thing.
Yeah, there's a big East Texas is extremely fertile. I mean, well, the Oak Ridge Boys is up from around where you're from. You know, Lawrence, Colin Ray is from Greenville. Leanne Womack's from Jacksonville. She and I were high school friends. We knew each other about a quarter mile down the street from me. And I would go down there with my guitar when I was a junior in high school. We'd play, try to figure out Judd songs and all that. I ended up playing on the road with her up here for a while too. So she and I have known each other for a very long time. Oh. Jason Sellers is from Gilmer. Of course, Miranda is what town is she from? Near
like North Texas, like
Casey Musgrave from Alba Golden.
That's
that little Northeast quadrant has got a ton of country music people and roots in it for sure.
Yeah. So was this an impression on you? Like in whatever your generation would be, like maybe the Oak Ridge Boys or something? Like yeah, did you know this thing?
Yeah. I mean, I tell people all the time, country music was just a cultural thing for when I was growing up. I was a young kid in the 70s when Willie and that stuff was happening, but I was hyper aware of it, of course, George Strait in the 80s. And so it took me a while before I figured out that not everybody else was just as deeply ingrained and obsessed with it as I was. And it took me till after I was up here for a while before I realized that a lot of people just kind of ended up in Nashville, a little bit by accident. Some of them end up in the music business because they think it looks fun, not necessarily because they love music. You know what I mean? So, but for me, growing up in Texas, it was just a deep-rooted identity thing as much as anything. I mean, I've got pictures of me wearing a cowboy hat when I'm 11, 12, and, I'd probably never been on a horse, but it was a whole urban cowboy thing. It was just what we did, man. It was just what we did.
It was the culture. I mean, you're just so inundated in it. Like it is in your blood. It's so much in your blood. You bring the dirt with you.
Yes. 100%.
I can totally relate to that. And you mentioned Leanne Womack. I didn't know that. I didn't know you played for Leah for like a little bit. Like, is this like the Hope? I Hope You Dance years or just a little bit before?
Oh, it's fun. Well, all right. You want a quick story on if you're going to mention I Hope You Dance. So I went to school at Baylor, which is in Waco. Uh-huh. And when I was there, I was in a band, a country band that would play all those clubs. And we were named we were called the Sons of the Desert. Like we started that band. All right.
I'm so glad you mentioned Sons of the Desert, but please continue.
Okay. Well, so I was the original lead singer of the Sons of the Desert, lead singer in quotes. Okay. So, I mean, I was a good enough guy if you were drunk in a college studio on Thursday night.
Oh, Texas. So, band. Perfect.
So, all right, I'm just going to tie the Leanne thing together. So I'll go to high school with Leanne, mid-late 80s. I go to college at Waco. I start a country band. We name ourselves Sons of the Desert after an old Laurel and Hardy movie for some reason that is lost to history.
Yeah, no, I only played
for a year or two, but it was while I was in college. And so it was awesome, man. I'd go out on Friday, Saturday night, and the country was exploding, especially down there. Every college kid went two-stepping. That's all they did. I mean, it was a thing. And so we would have lots of gigs and make pretty good money for a college kid. So immediately, after graduating, I quit Sons of the Desert. Drew Womack replaces me, which you may know his name, another Texas guy.
I do.
I moved to Nashville. I still kind of stay in touch with Leanne. She gets a deal in the mid-90s. I go out on the road as her road manager. She didn't have a road manager when she was first touring. Our first tour was with George Strait in all these stadiums. It was ridiculous. Anyway, that wasn't my first job, but I'm just jumping ahead. So anyway, I went out as a road manager. Then I left that to go do some other stuff. That's when I Hope You Dance hit, which is all country music historians know that the background singers were who? Sons of the Desert.
Yeah.
So like my whole life was coming together before my eyes in the biggest song on the planet, you know, with my high school friend singing a song with my former band guys singing the background on it. It was pretty strange. Pretty strange, man, I got to say. And then it was after that that I went on the road with her for several years just playing guitar with her and stuff like that.
I have to say your past mimics my present. Like, I just feel like, because like for me, like Sons of the Desert, and I feel like if anybody knows who Sons of the Desert is, like one, you really know something about country music, but yeah. Like they were a thing like in Nashville. I've met so many people that are like, oh, do you remember Sons of the Desert? And that's almost like a test. That's almost like a quick test. And like, if you knew, like you knew, like they were, what can I compare it to? I don't know. It was just like, if you like this certain John Mayer record, then like you're in, like, you know what I mean?
They were very, they with Drew being a singer and such an amazing singer and a great artist, all those guys, they morphed into something. We were a bar band when I was in it, but they morphed into a real thing. And I honestly just thought they were ahead of their time. I think if they would have come five or six years later, it probably would have been a different story. Plus, you know, as surviving the music industry, you know, they had all their travails with labels and weird song things happening and all that. So I still stay in touch with those guys and proud to, you know, have that little chapter in my history for sure.
Yeah, that's an amazing history. Yeah, country music isn't good to bands. That's something I've noticed. Like there's a poison, or there's just something about bands and country music. It never works out.
It's, Alabama being kind of the first. I mean, if you don't want to count like Bob Wills and Texas Playboy, those are still solo artists. Like Alabama was the first, you know, rock and roll, not that they were rock and roll, but like, whereas rock was always about the band mostly.
Yeah.
It was Zeppelin and, you know, Skinner, you could just go through all those. And then Alabama kind of brought that into country, but then, since then, I mean, you're usually more of a vocal band, like a Flax or something like that. But you're right. Just a Diamond Rio had a good run. I mean, we can name it, but you're right. If you ever really want to get freaked out, just go back and try to find a list of all the people who had record deals in the 90s. It's hundreds and hundreds. And it's, you kind of like, oh my gosh, I kind of remember Mason Dixon. I kind of remember them, you know, you can go on. So.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I've talked to Terry McBride on this thing. We talked about The Ride. You know, I could think of some of my favorite bands like Blackhawk or something. You know, they've had huge hits, but where are they now? You know, you look at that history and the things that they've been through. It's just kind of like, oh, man, like this That's is about, like
they have a hard time with longevity, you know, and I may that may be by design of it not just being a singular focus artistically. I don't know. Whereas the, you know, the solo acts, I mean, country is still the only format that regularly allows people to have 15, 20 year careers. I mean, you cannot find that. I'm talking about radio driven careers. It's just, you don't see that anywhere.
Yeah. So, I agree with that too. It's kind of an anomaly. Maybe it's just because of the country base, like country fans are just loyal.
I think that's it. Yeah, I think
so too.
And radio, by in turn, is loyal, and they tend to have less transient programmers, kind of stay there longer. Now that feels like it's changing, and it's, you know, but at least back in the day, for sure.
Yeah, we'll probably get to that in a second, especially radio and songwriters. But here's something that I just never really knew, unless you already answered like the question. Like, was Liam basically the bridge, like, for you to Nashville? Like doing the tour managing?
No. I mean, I didn't know she was moving up here. I knew she lived here, but it didn't have anything to do with it. I mean, at that time she was working at a daycare, and I mean, it wasn't like, I'm gonna move up to work with Leanne. It was like, I knew I wanted to be in the business. And although I had been playing in bands and playing guitar and actually writing songs since I honestly can remember, at least writing, I did not move up here to be a songwriter. I moved up here with the goal of running a record company. That was it. That was my focus.
Did you get your MBA from Baylor?
That's from Vanderbilt. Vanderbilt. Yeah, that was a interesting choice for me.
because the thing is business songs.
Yeah. I'm just a man of a jackass of all trades is what I like to say.
But songwriting is not good business, right? Like, you know this, right?
Well, my joke was, my joke has always been the NBA, the only way the NBA has helped me in my songwriting career is that I actually understand all the ways I'm being screwed. So, I can explain it to you. Oh, no, here's what they do. Oh, now, but no, that was like I was still working at the label when I did the NBA thing. So I thought, if I go back to school and get this, then I'll know so much about business. It'll make me that much better at running a record company and all these things that I just, for about the first 5 years in town, I thought I was going to do. My first job was literally, which I'm proud of, was in the mailroom at Capitol. It's cliche, but it's my cliche. And so then I was actually in the finance department for several years at Capitol. And then the longer I was on that side of the business, the more I realized I probably was displacing myself a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, even during this time, like, were you writing songs like during this time? Like just
for fun,
hobby, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. And in retrospect, it really blows my mind. I would literally, the two things that keep poking their head out is like, I would listen to these records of some of the artists returning in. I would go, I can write better songs than there. And I didn't realize not everybody in the room was thinking that. It was like, this must be normal. And then I would go home from working all day, stuffing envelopes for Garth, and I'd write songs, but I'd never go, hey, maybe I ought to be writing songs. It was just like, oh, yeah, that's just something I do on the side. That's for fun,
See, that's crazy.
Yeah.
That seems so crazy to me because, you hear the stories, and I have this story too. Like, you just didn't know what a songwriter was. You didn't know that, that job existed, but you did, but never had that thought of, I really should be doing this. Like, this is the thing I should be doing at the time.
Well, you're right. I understood that there was, my brother moved up here to specifically be a songwriter. So he actually had a very focused vision. So I was extremely familiar with the fact that it is a job. My hang up was like, it's not a real job. And, what are my mom and dad going to say? And why did I go to college if I'm just going to sit around and noodle on a guitar, right? It's not a legitimate pursuit. I don't know why I had that hang up, but I did. I did. I just thought it wasn't for me. It's not a job for me.
Yeah. I mean, you saw the great of the great. Like, you saw the money side of it. You know what I mean? If you're working at Capitol during this time, I guess Garth would have been the thing, right?
I worked from Capitol from 91 to 96, which is Garth absolute explosion. Mm-hmm. The only music you could buy were CDs. It was so unprecedented and such a time capsule of peak country and peak music industry, So it was a fascinating time. I didn't have a baseline perspective. I knew people were able to get jobs. I knew I was getting, my checks were clearing, and I knew we kept hiring people, but I didn't know that it was as special as it was until things changed, when Napster hit and all that, it was just like, you don't realize how good you got it, of course, if you're in the middle of it, and it's all you know.
Yeah. So what was the switch for you? I mean, because I feel like you're living somewhat of a cushy dream. I mean, you're living in an office. You're writing songs as a hobby. I mean, you're doing it. What was the thing? What was the launch pad?
The big switch for me was it was 10 years after I moved here that I actually threw my hat in the ring to say, all right, I'm going to pursue writing. Like, this is what I'm going to do. And so during that 10 years, now we're getting into the struggles. So All of that 10 years was leading to that moment. Of course, I didn't realize at the time, you know, I got a job at a label. I was excited. It was amazing. I learned a ton. It was the exact right place I should have been at the right time. But then I kind of got sidetracked by going into the finance department. I'm still very thankful for that experience. I learned a ton, but I knew that wasn't where I wanted to be. And I'm going to keep getting Texas-y. A friend of mine, guy, if you want to go real deep, do you remember an artist named Daryl Dodd from Texas? You may not. Okay. Daryl Dodd, who went to Baylor. He was a friend of mine from Baylor. Great singer, great guitar player, good looking dude, awesome guy. He got a record deal in town. So me, him, and my brother were always running around together. And the joke, semi-joke, was like, okay, well, Daryl's going to get a record deal and be world famous. Jim will be his manager. Brett will write the songs. Okay. So kind of a joke, kind of not. Well, Daryl ended up getting a deal at Sony in the mid 90s. Well, at that point, I'd been in the finance department. I was like, you know what? This is not for me. And Daryl asked me to be his manager. So I quit Capital to be Daryl's manager. And so I guess the dream changed from working at a record company to be a manager. I don't know what I was thinking.
Yeah, man. Whew.
Again, I learned a ton. The Daryl thing did not work out. He got very sick and kind of had the career had to stop. Mm. And so that's another thing that just did not go the way. I just knew he was going to be the next Garth and I would be this rich guy when I was 30 and I'd be back to Texas with all this money and all this. So
you'd be the colonel.
And it would be easy street. And so anyway, everything I could have hoped for the Daryl thing went the other direction. Then another label opened in town called Virgin Records that Scott Hendricks was heading up. I got a job there because I'd also been on the road with Leanne being a road manager. I didn't want to be a road manager either. So I tell a lot of people, and mainly my kids, you know, learning what you don't want to do is almost as important as what you want to do. So all these jobs I kept doing that I knew I didn't want to do were leading me toward what I wanted to do. So the short story is worked at Virgin Label. They got closed, lost my job. Capital then hired me again. And then 2 years later, they had a huge round of layoffs. And that was my number got called. And it was by that point, I'd already been thinking, you know, if I'm going to get kicked around by the business, why not get kicked around? It was literally that thought hit me like an epiphany. If I'm going to get kicked around, why not get kicked around doing something I really want to do? It was that simple. And it took me 10 years to figure it out. And so that's what I did. So I said, all right, I'm going to be a songwriter now.
I mean, what do you got to lose? I mean, that's the same mentality, right?
I was like, look, every road I've gone down has not worked out the way not only has it worked out well, it hadn't worked out any way I thought it would. It hasn't led to the next thing. I keep taking these sideways steps, these, you know, not controlling my own destiny within reason steps, companies being closed down, even when I was doing a good job. You know, you lose your job a few times, not by your own performance. That gets to you. You wish you had a little more control, which I know is an illusion. But so, yeah, it was literally like, well, man, if I'm going to get knocked around, why not get knocked around being a songwriter? A, it's something I enjoy. B, the lifestyle of it looks great. You don't have to be at work at 8. You get to hang out with people. And C, you know, there is a chance that you show up one day and create something that's worth $1 million. You know, there was an upside financial. So it was a head and a heart decision for me. And I made it at the time. If you want to live up to the title of your podcast, you know, I was newly married. We had a baby. I mean, it was the worst possible time on paper. It made no sense. And, it is literally my proudest moment of my working life that I took the chance when I did. And thankfully it worked out for me for a while, at least. So, yeah.
So I almost got my MBA. Like I was this close to doing it as well. Like I was studying the GMAT, my scores were looking good. And I
want to go.
Wherever, whatever. It was mostly a flight. You know, can I do this? Because it does interest me a little bit. But what I learned out of the experience is that, you know, like if you're pursuing an MBA and you're doing those studies, like it's a lot about thinking ahead and accurately thinking ahead as much as possible. So to me, that equals security. And then also strategically mapping out. I guess that's all kind of wrapped up into the same thing. But with all these things like the sand shifting underneath you, and then go over to the songwriting with the with part of the mentality of thinking, yeah, the lifestyle looks good with $1 million. That's possible. That's not a guarantee, right? So I mean,
it's possible, but my head was like, it's not possible if you're working for salary at a label, you know. It's not. I mean, unless you, I guess, become the CEO or something where you get a big bonus or something. But just you know, being a guy in the marketing department or whatever I was doing, you know, it was a little of both. I mean, the NBA thing, man, I don't regret doing it. I don't think it was necessarily life altering. I don't know if I would do it again if I went back. I don't think about it much. It did teach me a lot of critical thinking skills that I use all the time. And I did meet a lot of good people. So, you know, I try not to regret it. I guess my one piece of advice that actually, when I was trying to decide if I should do it, I actually heard from three or four people and I completely didn't listen to them. And I should have. They said, I would only do it if you know exactly why you're doing it. And I didn't. Sounds like you. Sounds like you're like, well, might be a good thing to do. I don't know what else is going on. Maybe I'll do it. Like, I didn't know why I was doing it other than I felt like it was a move forward. But the people it really worked out well for were the ones who were working at companies who were paying for it for them and who said, if you jump through this hoop, we will promote you to this level, you know. So that was probably my mistake, if there was one.
Yeah, that definitely reflects onto me. And I remember one class sitting through, there was an attorney, and he was like a really douchebag attorney. And I just thought, I don't want to be that. Like,
I'm
that's not for
joke
me.
About that being redundant, but yes, go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, got her. Oh, and also, the thing I probably love you the most is like, dude, you're like low key funny. Like, you need your own, like, you need your
own. That means not very funny?
No, that means like you will throw out something so quick and nobody will even know, like, what hit them. That's comedy. That is so good.
I'm a big comedy nerd, and, you know, my extremely dry, quick way of looking at the world equally entertains and gets me in trouble. So I've had to learn to I just say whatever pops in my head. I've gotten better at it, and I don't really think about it. I've hurt people's feelings I didn't mean to hurt. But yeah, I like making people laugh and having a good time, man. I mean, it's just, that's what it's all about to me, man.
I feel like that even, you need your own thing, by the way. But if you're afraid to get in trouble, you probably don't want to do this, because things will just go flying and you have no idea what's happening. Yeah. But even the music that you write, there's so many like comic sensibilities. I mean, obviously, we talk about Red Solo Cup, but then also like Hot Country Nights and stuff, and your stuff with Bobby Bones. And like, these are just patterns like I picked up, and not even knowing you personally, like there's humor within you. And I feel like if you just have the story of shifting sand of like life underneath you, and you can just look at it and laugh, you're a good dude.
It's just always how I've seen the world. And like you mentioned, Hot Country Nights. I mean, if there was a big market for cleverly written country songs, I would be, you know, Ashley Gorley, I guess. I don't know, but
I think so. I 100% think so. And even how I grew up, you know, I grew up with like comedy records. You know, what was the country guy? Not Rodney. He was the bigger Living on Refried Beans. That's the only song I can think of. He did like the Tim McGraw spoof. Cletus T. Judd.
That was my, all right, if you really want to tie this together, you're very insightful. That was my first cut with the Cletus T. Judd song.
No, yeah. I had no idea. What was it?
And I'm very proud of it. It was not only my first cut, it was Cletus's first original, right? It wasn't a parody. And it was called The First Redneck on the Internet. And this is like in 96, bro, where the internet was like, the what? And
it was right.
Buck Owens sang on it.
Buck Owens sang the chorus.
He sang the chorus on that song. Yeah, I met Cletus randomly. I said, hey, man, we met each other on the Walmart tour. They used to do this thing called the Walmart tour. These acts would go play in the parking lots of Walmarts, if you can imagine.
I've been there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I said, hey, man, you know, I know we don't. I said, I kind of write funny songs. And I, you know, played him a couple. He's like, dude. And so we wrote that song and he cut it. And then he called me and said, yeah, Buck Owens is going to sing on it. I'm a big Buck fan. I was like, oh, hell, this is easy.
Right.
This is, you know, yeah. Yeah. Man, you talk about just comedy. I love Roger Miller. I love Jerry Reed. I love Dave Stevens. I love Steve Martin. I used to love all the crazy novelty songs, not just country, but all of them. And I just love them. And that is a direct line to stuff like Red Solo Cup and the Hot Country Night stuff and all that. So I love it. It's not much place to go for it today. There's not, we don't have any Jerry Reeds or Roger Millers that are very willing to artist wise to look to have fun. They all have this this seeming very deep seated need to at all times look really cool, which they're very scared of doing anything. It's not what they deem cool. I don't understand it.
Man, we are meant to be friends because yeah. I agree 100%. Like to me, there's not like the characters in country music as there used to be.
The stuff Paisley was doing, there nobody's doing that now. And we can go real deep on this. And because my thing, I tell people, I'm like, look, man, back when movies came out in theaters, if you can remember that, yeah, I said every weekend there's two movies come out. One of them's a comedy. Every weekend, people like to laugh, people like to smile, people like to have a good time. And I'm not saying we got to write goofy, you know, songs like The Streak or Novelty, but man, you listen to hip hop, their stuff's hilarious, man.
Yeah,
but it's cool, yeah. It's cool, yeah. And hilarious. But some of the lines are really, really funny and meant to make you laugh,
right?
And there's something happening in country, man, where you got to have your hat down on your eyes and you got to be really cool. And I just always want to go, man, when you get around with your friends, is that how you act? No, you cut up, you act stupid. So I don't understand it. And it is what it is.
Man, maybe I would say, I hope so. I was kind of hoping Wheeler Walker was going to be part of that, you know, Ben Hoffman doing his shtick. But it just kind of never really caught on. Maybe he was in a different plant. But I love the idea of somebody like if Brantley Gilbert sang a song about an apple teeny, you know, like if there was just something about his raw cutting edge and he just likes hanging out with his bros with an apple teeny. That's funny to me, you know.
There's a guy named Funtry, Funtry, that has put out a couple of really funny songs. Check him out.
I will.
And like Wheeler Walker, I wrote some stuff with him, and I just think his stuff actually sounded really, really good. You know, obviously his was more so dirty. You know, it's not going to be for the mass audience. And I got very uncomfortable writing some songs with him. I mean, I can do it, but I did it under an assumed name. I'll just say that. You're not going to see my name. I don't want my
kids. Was it Rider X?
What's that?
Was it Rider X?
No. It was
different. No, okay.
It was not Rider X. But yeah, I didn't want my name, my kids, or my wife, you know, Googling my name and hearing some of these songs. Now I've added myself, of course, so we'll see how that goes.
Oh, yeah. Sleeping Around is still one of my favorite songs. He wrote that with Shane McAnally, and that's such a good song.
Great, man. It's great. Yeah. And he did pretty well with that stuff. I think Ben got burned out. I mean, it's a lot when it's a persona and you're out playing shows and it can get away from it pretty quick.
Right. I mean, he was Borat 24/7. It's not like he was Borat for like 3 to 6 months. You know what I mean? Like that does something to your identity.
Yeah, it's a weird place to be when you create a character, you know. So
yeah. Well, okay, riding this train of songs, do you, and I always have to ask this,
and I feel like I have to. Do you get tired of talking about Red Solo Cup? Like, do you just not ever want to talk about it ever again?
I've gone through periods where I it's not necessarily I get tired of it. I kind of just don't. It still fascinates me of what an impact that song made. I just kind of don't get it. There's not a week that goes by where somebody would bring it up, and I'm just like, I can't believe of all the songs, that's the one. And ultimately, I'm grateful for it because it was a lot of fun. It is a little weird for that to be the one that almost everybody knows about you. But, because you going back, going against my own word, like, well, you want to be like, well, I'm not just a, goofy songwriter. I've written some other ones too. But ultimately, I arrive at, you know what? It had a huge impact. It was perfect storm. People either loved it or hated it, and whatever it is, it is. It's fine with me.
You know, when I first heard it, I thought, okay, Toby Keith, it makes sense, because I didn't have this thing on the other side of the curtain. You know what I mean? But then, like, when you sit down and listen to it and just think, well, this is kind of a funny song. Like, this is, like, really clever. Like, this is, it's not a jab by any means, but this is, like, this is a culture. Like, this is the Red Solo Cup, and it's always a good time. It represents fun. It's this thing, and just, it happens to sound like a redneck anthem in a way.
Well, that's what I really learned from that song. I mean, I knew it intellectually, but then I learned it real world, the power of we the guy that wrote it with Warner Brothers and my brother, we didn't invent the Red Solo Cup brand. I'm not talking about the physical cup, the association of it with good times and drinking. We didn't invent that. What we did is we wrote a song that took advantage of it, right? So that's how you get a cultural huge song. If we would have had to have defined what Red Solo Cup meant in somebody's brain, the song wouldn't have made any sense. That thought was already out there, and that song just hit it. And it, red cups to most people mean fun, and all we did was write something that tied the two together. And it's very, very interesting. Well, also the power of a physical, I know that's not a Red Solo Cup, but a physical product, the power of branding. If you've talked about NBA, you understand marketing and the power of brain share and how people associate certain things with certain other things. And the power of naming a song after an actual physical noun, an item, not an idea, right? And pulling those two things together is very interesting. Like Cop Car for Keith Urban, right?
Right.
Those titles, instead of, You Were My First Love being the title, you call it Summer 69, right? You pull a physicality to it that connects things. It's really an interesting thing. It's too far in the weeds for songwriting, I know, but I'm fascinated by it,
But no, that's, I guess maybe that's my point too, because, I mean, you brought up Roger Miller. Like, only that guy could think chug-a-lug.
Yeah.
Watch somebody tipping over a moonshine bottle and chug a lug, like just the sound, and think to make a song out of it.
It's there's a certain genius to it for sure with what he was doing. No, yeah. I love Roger Miller, love him.
Yeah, but what's like? I feel like there's no answer to this, but it's just a light bulb, right? You see the cups, everybody's having fun to it, but what makes you think to take this mundane, ordinary thing? Because you do this in comedy, you see this thing and it's funny to you, and then you just expand upon it, and then it's so relatable that makes everybody think, "Oh, well, I do that too,"
Yeah.
And so,
as a writer, my antenna is up 24/7 for noticing things that are going on, And that's how that idea came about. I was, every writer keeps a list of ideas on their phone usually. And
how big is your list? Like, do you happen to know?
I could put it on your Zoom thing and scroll through it for about a minute and a half.
Could you please?
Yeah. Well, it would make sense to you. It would be like,
you know, Girl at a Diner, or just something. Any, I write down anything and everything that pops into my head that I think could be something. And I can show you, well, I mean, I'm not going to actually be able to find it because that would be the probably the most, you know, there's song ideas, as you can see, the list.
Right, right. Yeah, I see song ideas as a title, and you're scrolling through, and there's, like, is each line just a quick idea? Because there's hundreds.
We're about two-thirds of the way down. I wrote down Red Plastic Cup on this list, so you can see where it happened. So, yeah, I was walking through a tailgate area at a Vanderbilt game, and I don't know why, but I just noticed everybody was drinking out of the red cups. I was like, oh, wow, man, red cups. Everybody's got these red cups. You know, I was with my 10-year-old son at the time. And I just wrote it down. And then fortuitously, about 2 weeks later, the TV was on at the house. I was walking through the room, and I don't know if it was a movie or a commercial, but they were playing beer pong. And they had the red cups. And I was like, there's those red cups again. And that was enough for me. I was like, there's something going on. And that was it. So if you want to ask why, I was like, those two seemingly not connected things were enough for me to go, something's going on with the red cups. The universe is telling me that I need to write it. So
I feel like my personality, I could have said, yeah, I'll just write something funny and I'll just do it because this is something in my brain. I can't get it out of my brain and I'm going to put it on paper and it'll be the thing. But I feel like for some people it's a risk, right? Like it's almost like, why put that on paper? Like why spend the time to do that if it might not go anywhere, you know?
Well, yeah, I've just learned that as weird as an idea may seem to me, if it keeps knocking on my brain, if I don't get it out, it won't stop knocking. So that one kept knocking. And I, you know, to your point, I kind of started it by myself before I brought in the other guys. You know, I if you listen to the song, there's no way anybody was writing that was thinking it would ever turn into anything commercially. It's too weird and non, you know, I was writing it just to be funny and to get it out of my head. I never in a million years thought anybody would record that song.
Yeah, it's an anomaly. And was it a number one?
It only got to number seven on the like mainstream country charts. The only time it got to number one was when a website did a poll of the worst songs ever written. So
it's number one.
That's the truth. It finally made me one. I can't even like Pitchfork or Rolling Stone, somebody, and it was number one.
So it's a number one.
It made it. It made it.
That's it. The other thing that fascinates me, and I always think about this, when I think about Brooks and Dunn, I think about Terry McBride because he did just a lot of his catalog, right? So I think about Dierks Bentley, I think about you and your brother.
Yeah.
That is a relationship. And the relationship with an artist just like Dierks, like, that's amazing to me. One, that an authentic working relationship can last this amount of time and actually, like, really have good stuff. Like, maintaining that relationship. That's something I've never been really great at, but that says something about you. I'm just not sure what that is.
Well, I mean, I can't say enough good things about Dierks just as a guy. I am not a celebrity guy. I could care less about fame and the game. I know it's part of what we do, but he's just a good dude. He's the kind of dude that you just want to be friends with and hang around with. As far as the long-term nature of our relationship, in fact, my brother and I, that's where I have to go today. We're writing, trying to start getting some stuff for Dierks, you know, some ideas and brainstorming today. That's what we're doing. It's funny you even bring it up. And, you know, that's a 20-year relationship at this point. And my brother was his producer on the first four records. I don't know. I've never had it happen again where I was that kind of synced into somebody and what they were doing, you know. I just understood Dierks and what he was trying to do and was fortunate enough to have access to him and be friends with him to be able to write with him. But, you know, I will spend a lot of time coming up with Dierks ideas, right? And you know, it's like a funnel. You come up with a ton, maybe one of them actually is the right thing. So I just, but it's been a lot of fun, man. And he's just, we were texting this morning, you know, he's out there learning how to fly a plane or something right now. So he's a future Hall of Famer to me, I hope. So
I love that. Well, I'm a huge fan of Dierks Bentley. But did he have, was there like a, like, you know, Chris Stapleton had a struggle of like really having his break, right? I mean, was there like something like that with Dierks? Like it was just hard for him at the beginning? Like, did you know him that early?
Yeah, I knew him. You know, he did a record independently on his own, which is pretty good. It's called Don't Leave Me in Love. And and he wrote a lot of the songs on it. And that's kind of the what came to the attention of Arturo Buenahorra, who was working at Sony Publishing at the time. And he's the guy that kind of hooked him up with my brother, Brett. And I don't know if I would characterize Dierks's path as a lot of struggle. And I don't think he would either. I don't think he ever looked at it like that. I think everything was just like, for him, I love music. I love making music. I love playing music with my friends. I love writing songs. And he's one of those guys it just kind of happened for. I'm not saying it was easy. And I'm not saying he wouldn't say he struggled, but he's not the guy who was here for 10 years in town knocking on every door. I mean, right. he was a guy who had a real vision artistically at the right time. Good looking guy, had a unique voice. He's kind of everything labels were looking for and still look for, you know,
just right place, right time, and had the songs all rolled up in one.
Yeah. Now you mentioned Stapleton. I mean, I've known him for a very long time. We wrote a lot of songs before he
like Still Drivers, like before all that.
All that. Yeah. I mean, I've known him for a long time. And his was not, I don't think he'd say the only struggle was finding a label that would just let him do what he did, right? Everybody, it's still an easy thing to want to take somebody like Stapleton, who is Stapleton, but try to, hey, well, man, if you just be a little more commercial, or maybe if you write this kind of song, or maybe if you work with this producer. And I'm not saying he's unwilling or an unyielding person, but he also has had a very strong sense of, that's not who I am, that's not what I do, and it's okay. You know, it wasn't like this screw the town thing. It was just like, I'm going to do what I do, and I don't have to be famous to do it. You know, I don't have to,
I don't know him, but the guy's just too good. Like, just hearing the stories of, like, people being overwhelmed or, like, incomparisonable, like, there's no way they could sing his demos whatsoever. Like, that struck fear in the people's hearts and minds, like, to try to do what Chris does.
No question. In fact, he also had the opposite effect where he's so stinking good. He could sing the alphabet and make you say, I need to cut that, you know. And then a lot of artists would say, oh, I got to cut that song. And they'd get in there and they'd sing it. And they'd be like, I can't make it sound as good as he did. And it would scare him off. But he was a guy that everybody who wrote with him and knew him and ever heard him sing was like, if he ever gets the right opportunity, there's no question he's going to be a thing. Like, not just, oh, have you heard this guy? He's pretty good. He's going to be a thing. He had a crazy look. He had a voice that sounded unlike anybody. But it was always a question of, like, is anybody just going to let him do what he does? And, you know, because he's not going to fit any mold that radio or a label thinks they're looking for. So nobody was shocked when he blew up. They were just wondering when it would happen and how, you know.
Well, this makes sense. It's about time. Everybody had that same sentiment. I remember seeing Chris Stapleton like at Whiskey Jam, like before Whiskey Jam was even a thing at all. And then him just being him. And then you just sit there and wonder, where have you been? Like, why isn't this a thing? And I think, honestly, I think people are just too scared. He was just too good.
Yeah, he was. And he has no pretense, but you want to go back to like funny. That dude is hilarious. He and I wrote some of the funniest, weirdest little songs, you know. I would never play them for anybody, but he's hilarious, man. He's a great sense of humor, you know.
Yeah, do you guys still write pretty often?
What's that?
Do you guys still write pretty often?
No, you know, honestly, no. You know, it would be it would be hard to do anything very often, not only with COVID, just but where he is at his career, you know, it's right. just a different. When you get on a rocket ship, you know, you can't hang out with your buddies on Earth as much, you know. So we still text every now and then, and you know, he's just on a different planet at this point.
I have to say, probably my favorite song that I'm aware of that you wrote, co-wrote, is Watching Airplanes. Like, I feel like Gary Allen, like, I'm just a huge fan of Gary Allen. And just Watching Airplanes is one of those epitome of songs to me. Like, in the hierarchy, and I don't have a favorite song, but if there was, like, that would be in top one of fingers that I'm holding up of top songs. And I can't place a reason why. Because it's just like, and I've talked to Jonathan Singleton about this, and understanding his sensibility, how he writes, I want to get your feel, like, especially your writing sense. But that song is just a guy hanging out and imagining. You know, it's such a atmospheric head game storytelling, you know, which is not very tangible, like, of country music, right? Like, it's just, and that's probably me overthinking it, which I tend to do that.
Glad you are. I take that as a compliment that you thought that much about it. Thank you for saying that about that song. I feel the same way about that song too, with no pride associated with that. That song was just a godsend. It was the first number one I ever had. It's Jonathan's first number one. It goes back to what I was saying about Red Solo Cup. You know, you don't say, I just broke up with, you don't call the song, I just broke up with my girlfriend and I don't know what to think about it. You paint a picture. You know, it's the old show them, don't tell them songwriting thing. The idea, that's another idea that if I scroll back on this list, you would see it pretty close to the bottom because a long time ago. All right, I'll tie it all together. If you want to know how weird this world works, the guy, Daryl Dodd, that I managed, had a song. One of his singles was called That's How I Got to Memphis. It was, I got in the 30s. Anyway, we shot a video for it. And one of the scenes, if you go find the video, there's one scene where he's sitting on the hood of a car and an airplane flies over him and he looks up. That's where I got the idea. And this was 10 years later. I saw the video. I was like, oh, that's kind of weird, man. The guy's watching an airplane. And I don't know, just popped in my head. Oh, I said, what if like his girlfriend's on that airplane, you know? And I wrote down Watching Airplanes. That was the title. And it was probably 4 years after that I was writing with Jonathan and I remembered that idea. And I said, I said, man, have you ever like broken up with a girl and like driven her to the airport and then sat up there and watched all the airplanes fly away and wonder which one she's on. And he said, no. I said, I haven't either. I said, but it sounds like a song, doesn't it? He goes, I don't know. I guess so. And that was it. I mean, but it was an idea that I had a very strong sense of, and you being a country music guy, it was maybe a year after that, I was like, that's Silver Wings by Merle Haggard, which is basically the same idea. And I never put this together. Of course, I love Silver Wings, but he's watching a plane fly away. But there's something so lonesome about it. I guess 100 years ago, it would have been, you know, standing at a train station and watching a train pull away. And but then if you want to get real in the weeds, since you seem to be a fan of that song, I think what connects with people is the weird, really unusual key change we do in the song, which was a complete mistake. But the best mistake I've ever made, you know, that's a big part. There's something so weird about that musically that everybody immediately, and I've tried to do it again and it just doesn't work. But
it doesn't work.
Yeah. And that happened because we wrote the verses. Actually, we wrote the chorus one day and then we had to stop and we got together to write the verses. And I'd written kind of a skeleton of that first verse, you know, sitting out here on the hood of this truck looking up, blah, 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 blah. And just to be weird and to be funny and to try to see if something would happen, I said, there's the first verse. I'm walking out. I'll be back in 10 minutes. You sing it, right? So for joke. And I came back in and he started singing it, which basically sounds what it sounds like. And Jonathan's an amazing singer, melody guy. And I said, I love it. I said, that's cool, man. It's cool. I said, but you're in the wrong key. We wrote it G, and you're playing a D. And he's like, oh, really? I was like, yeah, man. So can you? So we tried them, and then I don't know which one of us said, is there a way to just combine them? And then, dude, I have the work tape of us singing it in the room, and when that key change happens, you could hear me lose my mind. I lost my mind. I was, oh my gosh! I was like, that works. It works. So anyway, I think people like that part of the song, but yeah. I appreciate saying that. That too is it will always be one of my favorites I've gotten to be a part of, for sure.
It really should be.
I love Gary Allen.
Oh man, he's so good. I know you got a jet, but man, I literally could talk to you all day.
Well, I got probably 10 minutes. Gary's got a new record coming out this year.
I saw that. I saw that on the radar. I'm definitely going to check it out eventually. But I think one of the most genius moves, like an artist to agree to cut a song of yours, is Drink a Beer. Like, and it had to be Luke Bryan. It had to be Luke Bryan to cut that song. Because of the song title, you immediately think it's one thing. Coming from Luke Bryan, you immediately think it's the same thing. But then when you actually listen to the heart of the song, it means so much to so many people.
Yeah. Well, again, that's another good lesson to me and any other writers out there. You know, when Stapleton and I wrote that, we were not thinking about Luke Bryan. We didn't think about Luke Bryan and have his story and how he had, you know, lost family members early. In the same way that I didn't make people start using red solo cups when they had parties, right? So that's not anything I can take any kind of credit for, but it is part of the story that made the song, you know, what it was. That was not my role. Now the title being misleading, we did do that kind of on purpose.
Intention, right? I mean, there was superior intention and MBA smarts to say.
Well, I don't know what kind of smarts there was. Intention to flip the script a little bit. Now, I'll say this: that's another one where I had that chorus written. I'm going to sit out. I'm going to sit right here on the edge of this pier and watch the sunset disappear. Where I rhyme pier and pier, by the way, and drink a beer. And that was all I had.
Supreme rhyming.
And if you analyze it like we're doing, there is no context to that. Those four lines, there's nothing. You don't know why. And so Stapleton and I had to figure out why. And we tried a lot of ways, like, oh, maybe he just quit his job and it was almost a party song. I mean, we actually tried those things. And it wasn't until we landed on this really weird idea that the song's about that we had a big aha moment. We're like, okay, this could be something really interesting, you know? So I just kept chasing and kept chasing and but then, you know, you write it and you turn it in. Everybody's like, oh, that's kind of cool. It wasn't what I thought it was going to be. But then Luke hears it and he knows what it can mean to him. And it's one and one makes three. Very proud of that song. That's a song where if I ever do a writer's night or something, people come up to me and tell me stories about what that song means to them. And I'm just, you know, really don't know what to say and can't take any credit for it. And just am kind of like, flattered and speechless. So,
yeah, I mean, speechless is a good word because I don't know how to feel for a song that impacts somebody's life so much. Like people play that song at funerals. You know what I mean?
That's usually what I hear is either that was my uncle, brother, friend's, you know, best favorite song, or we played it at his funeral. And I don't know what to do with that information. I just kind of, I remember when Leanne had I Hope You Dance Out, you know, during her meet and greets. I mean, if you can imagine every story, not every story, but so many stories were, you know, that was my favorite song with my 11-year-old daughter who had cancer. I mean, it's just, you know, real life, almost always tragic, And I remember her saying, this is back in 2000, she's like, I almost don't want to do meet and greets anymore because I kind of don't know what to say. And I almost can't handle it emotionally, hearing these stories over and over. And on a way smaller scale, I kind of understood a little bit what she meant by that. So you don't know. We all say, the writers say, you know, once it leaves your pen, your email box, whatever, once you, it's not up to you anymore. It's in the world. More, it's like a seed that you literally threw up in the air. Most of them are not going to ever do anything. Some of them might grow. Some of them might die early. Some of them might grow to be 30 feet tall. Some of them might grow to be the most important plant in the farm. You don't know. You don't know. And I've heard other writers say that's why you write like a farmer. You go in every day, you work, you plow, you sow, you plant, and you just don't know what's going to come up. I don't know.
Yeah, that's the beauty of it, right? You just kind of never know. It's like kids.
And the frustration of it, because you do not control any of that. The last bit of control you have is when you turn it in. All bets are off, man.
Right. One last thing, and I'll cut you loose. Like, even on top of that, how many holds do you have today? Do you happen to know?
Holds?
Yeah.
Like people holding on?
Yeah, right. Not holding on to you by any means, like creepily, but like holds on songs.
Yeah. God, they used to be a much bigger thing than they are now. Like it used to be, I'm not saying like I don't care about them. I'm saying they don't happen as much for a lot of reasons. But I only know of maybe two, but I don't think about them anymore. Good for you. I used to get really excited. I'd lay in bed saying, oh, maybe, but I've learned my lesson on that one. It's like, again, I have no control. So I get real stoic. I'm like, I don't control it.
That's a hold. Cool.
Yeah, but if you start drilling down, you'll be like, oh, who put it on hold? Oh, well, the A&R assistant. Oh, okay. Oh, how many other songs? Oh, 137. Oh, okay. Well, when are they cutting? They're cutting in 2022. Oh, okay. You know, it's like you start drilling down the hold. You need some qualifying on that hold for it to mean anything to you. It needs to be, they're holding three, they're going in next week, and it's the first one they're cutting. That then you go, I might get a little tingle of excitement now, but
a little tingle.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. Like, because my thing behind that question is like, I want the hold to be extinct. The holds are a stupid, idiotic thing of just dibs. And I understand why Nashville does it. I understand why it's a thing, but we're not doing that thing in music anymore. If Drake can record a record like one night and release it the next day, why can't like country get behind that? The holds have like screwed me over so many times. That's why I'm so jaded by it. And that's why
we could have a long conversation about this. I tried for a while to fight the hold system. And I do feel like it's, the grip has lightened on the hold. Like I know now regularly publishers will have a song on hold and they'll keep pitching it. Whereas used to, they would not ever, you know, a Tim McGraw or somebody, I'm not putting him under the bus, would hold a song for 18 months or something. Mm-hmm. And I used to rail with my publishers. I'd be like, you know, in Hollywood, they call this an option. If you write a screenplay and somebody thinks they are interested in it, it's called an option. You know what they do? They pay you for the option. For you to take it off the market. And you know what else they do? They put a time limit on it. So, and they were like, it'll never fly. We'll never do that. And they never have done it. But you know, if you write a screenplay, they'll say, I'll give you $100,000 to let me sit on it for 6 months. And then you get to decide, the creator gets to decide, yay, nay, you know. So it's a real highlight on the supply demand problem we have in town. We have too many songs and too few places to go with them. So, of course, their power increases. That's my MBA at work. I just used my economics. Yeah.
It's used. There you go. Oh, we could really talk all day about the holds, but I know you really got a jet now. But, man, you're a superstar in my eyes. I'm a huge fan.
Well, I disagree with that, but I really actually had a lot of fun talking to you. It's always good to talk turkey with somebody in the business and from Texas and you know, whether you realize it or admit it or not, you know, these podcasts are a huge service. If I would have been a kid in Texas and had access to this stuff, I would have listened to every one of them I could. I would have gotten to have learned so much before I had to get here and learn the hard way. So a big shout out. Thank you to you, because this is an important service in a very specific area. So anyway,
yeah, it's a cool thing. Yeah, man, I appreciate that. All tens of my listeners will get so much out of it.
You know them all by name, you know, just give them a shout out. And
all right, man, have a good one. Make $1 million today.
All right, I'll only make $850,000. I'm not feeling too good right now, so.
And on this day, he did not write a song. I don't know. He probably did. I don't know. He probably just made $1 million, and I probably never hear anything of it or get none of that publishing. Welcome to me. I hope you folks enjoyed that conversation. I sure did. I wish I could point you somewhere to more Jim Beavers, but I cannot. He is an amazing songwriter. His head is to the grindstone. But you can try. Maybe there is something out there. I don't know. I can't find it. But Jim Beavers was an amazing conversation. And I wish him nothing but the best in all future winkety-wink projects. All right, folks. Keep in touch with us at SMI Podcast or at Unofficial Brandon on Instagram and the talks. Drop me a line. Send me a message. Like. Whatever. Whatever you do on the socials. I don't know what kids do anymore. And then on to the website. If you want to drop us a line, let us know how we're really doing. Send a nice email. I've never been so angry to write a stern email to anybody, so I don't get the people that do this. But anyway, you can drop us a line from smipodcast.com. There's links to do that. Send us an email. And then there are episodes every Tuesday. And then every once in a while, drop something on Thursday. Best way to stay in the know is to subscribe and follow in your favorite podcast app. It's out there. And then I guess that's it. All right. Just share it with a friend. That's the last thing. Love you guys. Take care of one another. Until next time, happy surviving.